All right, let me get this thing started up here so I can podcast whatever I happen to say. If you were interested in the Conduct of Inquiry book and you haven't bought a copy, there's some discount flyers up here. If people are interested, there's a little discount code thing associated with it. So I thought I'd make that available. All right, so what we're going to do today, what we want to do today is we want to talk a little bit about sort of just stuff that we've been talking about for a long time and has resulted in a variety of different kinds of products. It's a great myth that somehow scholarship is produced in isolation by individuals. It's actually not. Thinking is a collective process. So a lot of the stuff that shows up in Conduct of Inquiry is stuff that I've been talking about with a number of people over the years, including with Dan, among others. So there's a lot of sort of multiple voices that go on within these particular kinds of books. And similarly with our relationalism stuff, sort of grows out of these ongoing conversations we've had for a very long time. But I want to start off with one sort of very categorical kind of distinction that will sort of differentiate between the stuff I'm going to talk about and the stuff Dan's going to talk about, which is a distinction I make a little bit of in the book, between philosophical ontology on the one hand and scientific ontology on the other. And the basic difference here is philosophical ontology, which is what we often sort of refer to as methodology, is much more about the epistemic status of various kinds of empirical claims. And the reason I call it philosophical ontology is, as I argue in the book, because most of what we talk about under the heading of methodology is actually implications of certain kinds of philosophical positions about the hookup between the mind and the world, subject-object relations, mind-world relations. That's really what's being sort of signaled in there. This has implications for things like research design, how one thinks about causation, what one thinks the status of an empirical claim actually is. It is, however, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit, and that's what I sort of spend the book doing, that stuff is kind of indeterminate with respect to substantive theory. There is a whole different realm of scientific ontology. Substantive theory is about, you know, what's in the world. All forms of social science, all forms of science are, in a sense, worldly in that they refer to the world. They just have different meanings for exactly what that is. They also have a different, what you might call a sort of bestiary of what actually exists in the world, you know, what kind of flora and fauna and things are actually out there. Substantive theories of something like world politics have to have a kind of catalog of what sorts of objects are out there and what kinds of things we are actually studying. That, I would argue, is sort of the realm of more what I would call scientific ontology. And when Dan and I talk about relational theory, that is a scientific ontology. It's a position about what we should start with as our ontological and analytical primitives when we study the social world. Do we start with objects or do we start with relations between them? Do we start with categorical membership notions or do we start with boundary processes? That's kind of what the relational stuff is. This is not a direct one-to-one mapping between any of the positions in methodology or philosophical ontology that I talk about in the book. You could be a relational theorist and fit into any one of the different kinds of categories of methodology that I am going to talk about. You could also be any one of these categories and either be or not be a relational theorist. You could sort of start with relations in a variety of different sorts of ways. So right at the outset, I want to differentiate between philosophical and scientific ontology. I'm going to talk a little bit about the typology I lay out in the book as a typology of philosophical ontology. Dan's going to talk a little bit about the scientific ontology of relational social theory, and then we're going to kind of go from there. Now, I also say as a quick little caveat, Dan and I live in a particular place, not just America or Washington, D.C., though we do, in fact, live there, but we live sort of philosophically and methodologically in a particular place. We are relationalists on the scientific ontology side. We are also analyticists and configurational theorists on the philosophical ontology side. There is no necessary logical reason why this combination has to be the one that people use. All right? This is just the one that Dan and I happen to inhabit. But there is no strict one-to-one logical relationship between a particular scientific ontology and a particular philosophical ontology. And that's important to keep in mind because there are a number of relational social theorists who do things that are much more kind of statistical, neo-positivist hypothesis testing oriented. They still sort of share the same scientific ontology as we do, but cash it out methodologically in different ways. So with that by way of caveat, let me see if I can make this a little bit clearer. I'm going to try the low-tech version here. Instead of actually plugging in my iPad, I'm just going to draw this. The central thing for the book, and of course, it has to be the central thing for a book about social science because it has to be a 2x2. That's what makes it scientific, right? We all know that. So a nice 2x2 matrix is what makes things that way. What I argue in the book is that if we try to think about questions of philosophical ontology and methodology, that there are a couple of distinctions that are very useful, sort of ideal typically, for thinking about modes of cashing out the epistemic status of various kinds of empirical claims. And one of these has to do with the distinction, the question of how the mind is plugged into the world. Is it plugged in a dualistic way, or is it plugged in a monistic way? This is a distinction that I played with probably in print for the first time in an RIS article, I think back in 2008. And the basic distinction here, if you're a dualist, mind and world are in a sense two separate objects. Mind mirrors world. Knowledge is a representational copy to some extent of what exists in a mind-independent way. So to talk about a mind-independent world, or to talk about a character of the world that exists beyond our knowledge of it, that our knowledge gradually reaches out to and approximates, those are all dualist formulations of what it means to know something. Correspondence theories of truth fit into here. The idea that what we're trying to do is create some kind of a picture that actually shows us how the world works. Now, this is the dualist position is a fairly well-established one within international relations research, because it is one of the things at the heart of the procedure of hypothesis testing and falsification, which is often, especially in the United States, upheld as if it were somehow co-equal with the notion of science. This, as I argue in the book, is complete bullshit. Lots of different things pass as science, according to philosophers of science. There's lots of different ways of doing scientific inquiry. But for the most part, the sort of dominant hegemonic position in at least U.S. academic circles is this kind of dualist hypothesis testing position. But the dualism-monism distinction, if dualism is sort of the mind and the world being separate and representational copies, the monistic position is the idea that knowledge of the world and the mind is actually located in the world, that knowledge of the world is actually a constitutive process whereby there is no sharp subject-object distinction. That in fact world is a component of the way we know it. And when we start talking about knowledge of the world, we're always enmeshed in the way in which the world unfolds. This is a position that traditionally has been much more on display in fields like anthropology, certain kinds of sociology has been really big on this. If you kick around in the foundations of the modern social sciences, though, you find Max Weber, you find various other sorts of analyticists who are kind of interested in this particular position, that knowledge is not a representational copy, but is some kind of constitutive interaction with the world. All right. That's one distinction that I use. Now, there's another distinction that I think is necessary to kind of parse out the variety of kinds of scientific research that we do in international relations writ large these days, and that is the distinction between what I call a phenomenalist mode and a transfactualist mode. And that's kind of a weirder distinction, so I have to spend a little bit of time talking about what that means. A phenomenalist approach to knowledge, this axis up here basically deals with the question of how knowledge is related to experience. Right? So if you are a phenomenalist, then you would argue that we can only know objects that are in principle experienceable. We can know things that we can experience, that we have some sort of contact with. This does not simply mean, as old school British empiricists, of the David Hume variety would probably have liked to say, that we can only know things we can experience with our five senses. That's not what a phenomenalist position means. It's perfectly okay if you're looking through a microscope or a telescope. That's just a mode of extending your experience. So something that can be, however, perceived, whether with or without instrumental extensions of sensors, would be something that would fit into a phenomenalist point of view. Why that's important is because if you are a phenomenalist, then you think that knowledge cannot go beyond things that cannot, at least in principle, be experienced and directly perceived, which raises problems for things like states and social structures and things like this. Can these be objects of knowledge if there's no actual way to perceive them? If you can't build a structure detecting apparatus, then what does that mean about the sort of epistemic status of knowledge claims about structure? Not surprisingly, the first time this issue actually got raised in international relations is when people started talking about the epistemic status of structural theory. Right? This is kind of where a lot of this incursion comes from. The phenomenalists, better known as the people who would say within IR circles, it's not real if you can't measure it. I'm sure you've heard that. Or you have to operationalize it, which is usually code for you have to quantify it. All of that is just a technical manifestation of a phenomenalist philosophical position, which says things are real to the extent that we can touch them and count them. All right? So the opposite position would be a transfactualist position, which would say that knowledge can go beyond experience, penetrate through what one experiences and perceives, to get to the deeper, more subtle kinds of structural conditions that make possible those sets of experiences. There are a series of feminist critiques of the phenomenalist position, which I found very important with trying to think through how this goes. Joan Scott has this brilliant article on the evidence of experience that I think really does this nicely. Says, okay, we experience stuff, but we want to really get past that to think about these sorts of patriarchal structures that make possible certain kinds of experiences. And, she argues, those things can be objects of knowledge. We can know something about those trans-experiential, or the term I borrow from Roy Bascar, transfactualist kinds of things. And I borrow it from Bascar because the other big group in IR that's really been trying to flesh out what transfactualism is like is, of course, the critical realists. So this would be Colin White and Heikki Patamaki and Mario Covisto and people like Mila Kirkey, so on and so forth. Folks who've been arguing that there are, in fact, ways to penetrate through the empirical world to get to deeper levels of stratified reality. Right? So that's kind of what's at stake in that sort of argument. Now, why do I find this a useful distinction? Because if you start combining these things, you come up with some very interesting ways of talking about different schools of thought within international relations scholarship. If you are... Boy, that's an ugly N. I should probably change that one. Let's do this properly. We'll make that an N that actually looks like an N. NEOP, which is, of course, short for neopositivism. This is the dominant kind of what you might sort of caricature as American social science. The idea, it's sort of dualist and phenomenalist. There's a world out there, and we have to somehow build the best approximation to it that we can in our knowledge. And in fact, the way we do that is by restraining ourselves to the realm of experience and trying to formalize it and quantify it in various ways, test hypotheses about it, come up with general laws about how that actually real reality, which is mind independent, works, what its own logic actually is. You know you've built a good picture of it if the picture consistently fails to be falsified, which is, of course, the basic Popperian understanding of how science is supposed to work. Keep testing those hypotheses, because if you don't keep testing those hypotheses, you might accidentally start believing in something that's not actually true. So you keep testing it. Good Popperians don't rest. They just keep moving. So this is your neopositivist position. This is the one that is often caricatured as, quote-unquote, the scientific method, at least in IR. Certainly is not caricatured that way in the philosophy of science, where virtually nobody thinks this is the way science works, and virtually nobody thinks this is a meaningful logic for how scientific activity proceeds, even as a rational retrospective reconstruction. I mean, yeah, this is Kuhn and Popper Lakatos were sort of concerned about this, but their debate is a very small corner of what goes on in philosophy of science. Awful lot of philosophers of science these days are critical realists. And what's interesting about critical realism, right, is that obviously the main critique of neopositivism is that it is too wrapped up with things that can be perceived and doesn't get through to the deeper structures, or as critical realists will often say, the dispositional properties of objects. And the difference between a dispositional property and an empirical observation, of course, is that an object falling off the table is an empirical observation. A dispositional property of the object to fall off the table is not a finite empirical observation of how many times it fell off the table, but is a tendency to fall off the table. And parenthetically, one of the things about this sort of critical realist take is that actually a bunch of the neopositivist philosophers of science figured this out a long time ago and sort of started moving in that direction. So you read like late Carl Hempel, who was really big on the covering law thing, and he says, you know, the problem with covering laws is it can never really tell you why magnets attract stuff. Because all covering laws can say is like iron filings keep making these weird patterns around magnets again and again and again. In order to actually get to a law, we'd have to make some sort of an assumption about deep properties of the magnet. But those aren't empirically testable. Huh, isn't that weird? And that sort of opens the door toward this whole kind of critical realist approach, which has been fairly influential within sort of critical realist international relations. You get this in some of Wendt's work, start talking about dispositional properties of states. Obviously, Colin and Hakey's work, talking about dispositional properties of international structures, right? This is kind of where they go. It's transfactual, but it's still dualist. It's still a mind-independent reality out there someplace. Which is interesting, because it means that critical realism, when you speak it to a neo-positivist, sounds like a minor amendment. And they go, oh, yeah, okay, cool. I guess we can sort of expand this a little bit. And they sort of don't realize that what's actually happened is they've been pulled into a totally different philosophical ontology. And they go, oh, yeah, you think there's a bear out there, and so do we. So we're all on the same team. Great. They're really not on the same team. They're actually in very different kinds of places. But they agree on this major principle of dualism. Now, there are ways of doing constructing social knowledge that is not, in fact, dualistic, but is monistic, with much more mind in the world, world as constitutive of and constituted by various processes of mind. You would end up, if you were sort of a phenomenalist monist, analyticist, that is the analyticist box, which is a box in which, that's actually a Y, not an X. You would argue, if you were a phenomenalist monist, that in fact world and mind are not neatly separable, so knowledge is not a representational copy of the world. But because you are a phenomenalist, you would say the only objects of knowledge are those things we can directly experience, which means general notions that we use to make sense out of empirical objects are not themselves objects of knowledge. They are instrumental devices that we use to make sense out of what's happening in the world. Now, of course, this is a position that Weber rather famously articulated in the Objectivity essay in 1904, which was then badly translated as if Weber was some sort of positivist. He's not. They sort of ignore the parts where Weber said general laws are useless. What we're interested in is particular cases, which if you're a neo-positivist, you would never say something like that. But they sort of interpreted Weber as if he was sort of going in that direction, largely because the people who translated Weber into English originally were American neo-positivists. Right? So there's some weird translation ambiguities. But the original Weberian position of ideal typification is the world is a really big, complex place, and in order to make sense out of it, we have these analytical oversimplifications, these models that we use to highlight particular aspects of things. And then, after logically elaborating these models, we go into the world and we look at the case-specific configurational ways that these different principles interact with each other and produce case-specific kinds of outcome. Notice I've said case-specific twice. The end point of an analyticist project is always about case-specific narratives. There may be more than one of them in a book, largely because the publisher said you have to have three cases, but it doesn't add anything to it epistemically, right? The point of the exercise is to explain what goes on in a particular situation, or multiple particular situations. The ideal typical tools themselves are not objects of knowledge. They are instruments for producing knowledge. So, very different kind of approach. Parenthetically, if rational choice people actually understood what the hell they were doing, this is where they would live. They would not pretend that rational choice theory is a device for generating quantitatively testable falsifiable hypotheses. This has nothing epistemically to do with the basic idea. If the truth of a rational choice argument has to do with the internal logical coherence of the game, then whether it is empirically validated across multiple cases is irrelevant. And if the epistemic quality of knowledge is that it has to be generally true across cases, who cares if it's an internally consistent logical model that generated the hypothesis? The original hypothesis is totally irrelevant if you happen to be a neo-positivist. That's why Popper thought you could test religion, right? It didn't matter where things came from. It mattered what you did with them. So there's a kind of weird, unholy alliance between rational choice theory and neo-positivist quant stuff. It has a lot more to do with the sociology of the American Academy and the fact that they both use symbols. And it's like, oh yeah, you use weird symbols, we use weird symbols, cool, we can actually kind of get together. And Bill Riker kind of knits all this stuff together and then builds a place called Rochester, which like creates a bunch of people who think these things go. So there's a whole sociology and knowledge story attached to this. Point is, it's a sociology of knowledge story, it's not a philosophical story because they don't have anything to do with each other. Very different. Most rational choice theorists don't get this. Jan Elster gets this. Right, there's a couple of Jim James's students who get this. Those folks had this great article on modeling, was in the Perspectives on Politics a couple of years ago, who sort of get this, but most people don't. All right, that's three. Two by two, gotta have four. So, what goes in the fourth box? Turns out, I argue, what goes in the fourth box is what we would think of as reflexive social science. This is an interesting combination of the idea that mind and world are not separate, knowledge is not representational, but on the other hand, there's something more than what is actually experienced. And the more are the structures and social patterns and social positioning that underpins the situation of the researcher, him or herself. And so reflexive social science always says we must start with an account of our own position as knowers. And we start there, and that gives us a basis on which to theorize about the way society is put together. It is that critical self-knowledge which is the origin of things. None of these other three really take critical self-knowledge all that seriously as the major epistemic principle. I mean, you know, they're often okay with it. Yeah, cool, you want to tell me where that hypothesis came from or where you're working, that's nice. You know, I don't really need that. If you're reflexive, that's essential. Absolutely essential. This is why if you're an anthropologist and you're doing a certain kind of participant observation, if you do not start out with a chapter that identifies the ways in which you became a member of the community that you're working with and wrestles with the kind of ethical questions of doing so, then the account is not really worth all that much, right? So epistemically, that's where these kinds of things start. Still monistic because mind and world are still co-constituted. Transfactual because you get past experience to actually talk about broader kinds of deeper structures that actually constitute things. All right, so punchline. This is an ideal typical lexicon that I develop at some length in the book. And the purpose of doing so is to say we have for too long thought that science belongs in the upper left-hand box. There's a lot of different kinds of sciences out there, and they have different notions of knowledge, and therefore because of that they have different notions of rigor, they have different internal expectations what constitutes a good argument. They should in fact, someone who works in one of these traditions, should in fact try to be fairly consistent and try to actually live up to the standards of a particular approach to things, but there is no way to say one of these is science and one of them is not. They are all sort of legit players to this particular kind of knowledge game. These have implications for how we think about causation, for how we think about research design. If you're a neopositivist, obviously, you know, it's the KKV argument, large N is better N, because the more general, the better. That's not entirely the case down here. You use multiple cases for different reasons when you get down here. It's not necessarily the case you're looking for a general cross-case covariation. You're looking for a nomothetic covering law. You're looking for something else. So there's a lot more variation in that realm of what constitutes scientific knowledge. So what I've tried to do here is introduce ideal typically a kind of lexicon for talking about the logical distinctions between these things. It is an ideal type. It is not necessarily the case that this represents any actual schools or any actual people. Actual research tends to be a lot more mixed than the typology is. The point of the typology is to point out some of the interesting philosophical conundrums with which people have to wrestle if they want to try to think about crossing the streams. And, of course, as an ideal type, it is presented as though these were splendid isolation from one another. Of course, that's sort of the way you do it when you do ideal typical thinking. But the lexicon, I think, is much richer and much broader, allows us a little bit more of an interesting, contentious discussion about the status of knowledge. What it doesn't do is it doesn't give us any insight whatsoever into a substantive theory of world politics. That's not its job. It's not intended to be a substantive theory of world politics. However, relational theory is intended to be a substantive theory of world politics, and so with that rather artificial segue, I'm going to hand this over to Dan. Just put that on your lapel there. All right.
So I've been sitting here, you know, listening to Patrick's very eloquent presentation and thinking, first of all, that I feel guilty for not having prepared as well, but also thinking that, oh my God, how are we going to fit this together? Aren't you all going to be completely overwhelmed? The answer may be that you are and that it won't fit together, but I do think there are some connections. There are at least connections in Patrick's, in my mind, to the extent that we began talking about some of these issues back in the mid-90s when we were in graduate school together. And while this argument is much more Patrick, I have a very small contribution in terms of the incommensurability debate, but is largely Patrick's, that we were still kind of wrestling with all these issues at the same time, issues of philosophical ontology and issues of scientific ontology, because both of us believe that while it's important to argue at all these different levels and to try to be consistent across them, that at some level you do need to say something substantive about the world in one or more of these kinds of modes. I also think this is kind of interesting because as I was listening to Patrick, I was thinking about what the terms of debate are within people who might broadly be thought of as relationalists, which I will define shortly. And if you want to get a sense of just how much this is an ideal typical configuration rather than a set of boxes, the main axis of debate is actually here, right? It's on the diagonal. People who live up here tend not to embrace relationalist theories, although they use relational data. And people down here are often engaged in work that might be thought of as relationalist, but they're not having the same conversation. So it's possible to have a close family resemblance between substantive theories about, or scientific ontologies, where you're living actually in these apparently completely disparate worlds, right? Because the diagonals of boxes are supposed to have nothing in common. And I think that's a kind of interesting point. Now, the backdrop to this is that Patrick and I first began writing about what we awkwardly called a processual relational approach, and which we're now, for ease, just calling relationalism, in the mid to late 1990s. We published our first article on this in the European Journal of International Relations in 1999. Since then, we've written a few elaborations in various places, and we've both produced books that have deployed very different variants of relational theory. At the same time, there have been a number of people who have appropriated, cited our work, or have been involved in the same intellectual project that we've been involved in, and they too have produced various iterations of their own empirical work. And so a couple of years ago, we decided that we weren't getting the recognition we deserved, that is the collective group, not Patrick and myself, that it would be a good idea to try to put together some sort of edited volume or cumulative work which brought together people who were self-consciously working in a relational idiom in international politics, or the study of international politics, and sort of put this forth in a more programmatic way. We've been very slow moving on this volume. I came up for tenure, I went and worked in government, Patrick was working on this book, but we finally come back to it, and now we're thinking more systematically about how we're going to introduce and explain this approach. And so some of what you're going to hear today is sort of a guinea pig variant of this, you know, kind of how we're trying to think about articulating this in 2010, which is different than how we might have articulated it in the 1990s. So what is relationalism? Relationalism is a set of methodological wagers that I think can be best understood in terms of how they cash out a variety of problems that we deal with when we think about scientific ontologies or high theory. How do we cash out agent structure co-constitution? How do we cash out the problem of constructing general theories or abstract theories about international politics while taking historical contingencies seriously? Right. And third of all, how do we relate macro-level and micro-level phenomena, which is a distinctive category from agent structure issues, even though they're sometimes conflated? And one way, I think, to think about or to conceptualize how this all comes together is to actually go back to a very old, fairly influential 2x2, which is Alex Wendt's way of locating theories. Are you all familiar with his 2x2? He says, you know, okay, there are kind of two major divides about substantive theories. There's a divide about materialism, right, and idealism. So he says there's, you know, materialism is kind of over here, and idealism over here. So some theories focus on matter, material physical phenomena, and some theories focus on ideational phenomena, beliefs, meaning, etc. Then you have another dimension, which he says is holism, and another, which is individualism. And in essence, some theories are actor-centric or agent-centric, and some theories are holistic or system-centric. In actor-centric theories, and I'm going to define this a little differently than Wendt does, focus on the internal dispositions of actors, whether those actors are individuals, states, firms, non-governmental organizations, what have you. And it explains behavior or outcomes in international politics by kind of reconstructing those internal dispositions right before action takes place, right before the outcome happens. So in some individualist versions of this, we're dealing with human beings, you might think about mental states. What were a bunch of important decision makers thinking right before they made a decision? If we can reconstruct what they're thinking, then we have an explanation for what happened. And you can do this in an ideational sense, right? You can think about, you know, what were their dominant beliefs about morality and ethics. Or you can think about this in a more rational choice sense. What were their preference orderings before they acted? And if we can model or work out how their preference orderings or their values interacted, then we have an explanation for what happened. At the corporate actor level, you may have an approximation. You may write as if a state had beliefs. The state struggles for its security, and it will do what it can to maximize its security. Or you could think about it as if it had a utility function, right? The state has a set of preferences, and now it's trying to maximize its utility given a preference hierarchy in some strategic context with other actors with preference hierarchies. Or you could think about sort of organizational dispositions or political culture. There are a variety of ways you can cash this out when you're not talking about biological human beings. Holistic approaches, on the other hand, talk about the causal influence or focus on the causal influence of aggregate, really kind of high-level aggregate social orders or cultural orders. So as Wen argues, these tend to go from the macro level to the micro level. And they might say, for example, that we explain some outcome with reference to the culture of anarchy. Right? And we work down from whence cultures of anarchy. Or in English school theory, we look at primary institutions and we try to think about the functional relations between primary and secondary institutions, and then we explain outcomes by kind of moving down to what states are doing from there. These also have domestic politics variants. You know, some people say, okay, well, why does the U.S. Turn unilateral? Well, there's this dominant political culture of exceptionalism with the United States and liberal exceptionalism. And this explains why the United States has a disposition when it is free to do so to adopt imperial or neo-imperial policies. These are all sort of more or less holistic explanations. I'm departing more significantly from Alex's understanding of how this fits together. So, you know, Alex then goes through, and I can't remember exactly how it comes together, but, you know, his constructivism is kind of over here, and, you know, sort of, what is structural realism is like over here, and world systems theory is over here, and he goes through and maps a bunch of this stuff. You know, in terms of how seriously they take ideas versus material factors and individual versus holist, this is a continuum, not a 2x2. Well, the problem is that relationalism it fits the story, but not the way that Alex tells it, because relationalism is neither an individualist nor a holistic approach, right? It is here. That is to say that it takes neither aggregate social orders nor the dispositions of actors as the starting place of analysis, but instead focuses on, as the name implies, the relations among actors and other social sites, including, contrary Vincent and Emmanuel's claim, including objects, right, that is non-actors. You can have relations, intersubjective relations, with things, not just with people. So all relational approaches, and there are a wide variety of them, take this as the central focal point of analysis, as the starting place. Now on the flip side, and I don't think I'm going to talk about it now, but we can come back to it later, it completely rejects this access. Right? It's not that it rejects this access because it's a middle point. You know, we combine material and idealism. Most relationalists think this is a stupid way of talking about international relations. That what we describe as ideas is usually cultural phenomena. What we describe as material is really social phenomena. And then we neglect real material phenomena. Right, but it is indeed within relationalism there is more disagreement on any of these axes. Right, there are some people who think about this in more cultural terms, the content and symbolic meaning of relationships, and there are others who focus much more on the social properties, the positional, formal characteristics of relations. For example, to get a little bit ahead of myself, when you look at a lot of social network theory, which doesn't have to be relationalist, although it uses relational data, what social network theory does is it finds ways of measuring structural locations by looking at the way that people are, or actors, or social sites are tied to one another, and then it talks about those in terms of positionality. So, who is central to the network? Who is peripheral? Are there cliques within that structure who are not tied closely into other cliques, right? These are all formal or positional attributes rather than cultural attributes. That is, they say very little about what the basis of the clique relationship or what the meanings involved in the center and periphery relations are. But that's all I'm going to say about that. So, we had a lot of trouble dealing with this because my own variant of relational analysis comes out of social network theory. Right, so I use language which I've already used, like social ties, relations, patterns of transactions, etc. And I'll try to get a little bit more meat on these bones in a few minutes. But there are other people who don't use that language. Right? There are people who actually do post-structuralist variants of this. Foucauldian theory, for example, is a relational version of linguistic term structural theory, at least in some of its manifestations. So there are people who do use the language of discourse, discursive configurations, sign-signified relations, etc. And then there are also people who use the language of practices and social fields to do very similar kinds of analysis to what we're talking about. Although, again, none of these things exhaustively define what I've talked about as relationalism. So, What we ultimately realized is that these were different languages for talking about a similar kind of social ontology, in that they tended to overlap social network analysis discourse and practice theory. They tended to overlap on shared relational sensibilities. So a lot of the way that we're now framing this is to think about these three analytic languages, although I think definitely myself and to some degree you too tend to draw more heavily. I mean, I draw heavily here. Patrick tends to draw on sort of a combination of this. Most of the people in the volume, I think, are more influenced by the social network approach because they were hanging out in Columbia and working with Charles Tilly, and were adopting, you know, sort of language from his relational realism. Now, I need to explain this a little bit better before I stop. So, I've kind of given you a kind of around the, you know, sort of around the track version without talking that much about what's at the creamy center, right? So, as I've said, relational theories differ on the terminology they use to describe relations, but whether they write about social ties in networks, practices and fields, or discourses and discursive configurations, relationalists first begin their analysis by analyzing patterns of relations among social sites, whether respect to their social properties, cultural content, or both. Lodge their explanations for outcomes primarily in terms of mechanisms and dynamics inhering in those relations. Properties of these relationships that where the causation is happening here, rather at the internal dispositional level or at a top-down macro to micro level, which, as you can see, has an elective affinity with configurational analysis because you're looking literally at the configurations of social transactions to produce your causal story. And understand those relations and related mechanisms and dynamics as constitutive of both agents and structures. Right? At a thin level, what I've just drawn is a network diagram of a structure. Right? This is a social structure that involves relations, involves positional and configurational attributes, in which actors are constituted in terms of, at a thin level, their power resources, their influence, and perhaps even what beliefs and meanings they take up by their positionality. Right? So one of the standard arguments you're seeing a lot of now, this is in my work on early modern Europe and on empires, Charlie Carpenter's work, is to take the proposition that network centrality often connotes with it certain kinds of asymmetric power capabilities, which is drawn straight out of, you know, sort of quantitative informal social network analysis. So in that sense, you're talking about the terms of agency, right? But even further, because we're talking also about the cultural content, the meaning that make these relations, that inherent in these relations, are transmitted through them and can alter them, you also may be talking about the very nature of agency at a deep level itself derives from social relations, a common argument we hear in quote-unquote constructionist literature. And also that the structure itself is then, both on a meso level and a macro level, an aggregation of those relationships. Right. So there's a notion that you can get into agent structural constitution simultaneously by starting here and thinking then about how those concatenate to produce various kinds of more aggregate patterns of social relations. Moreover, there's an argument that you can start really taking seriously notions of what it means to be a corporate agent. Right? So one of the standard arguments that we've made and that we found and which we borrowed and adapted from Chuck and from Andrew Abbott and others is that when we talk about corporate agents like states, what we're really talking about are conditions in which you have a bunch of actors or social sites, these can be composed of actors or objects or whatever, who are connected to one another, in which empower in certain kinds of settings, and you may empower different subject social sites in different settings, empower those social sites to negotiate cross-boundary relationships with other relational configurations, and make claims then on the behavior of everybody else in that network. For the purpose. So, if you think about a decision to go to war, right, what you're saying is you're empowering a set of executives and maybe legislatures to make a decision to commit all of the people or all of the social sites, all the organizations on this side of that division to militarize conflict with this group. Right? You can think about the same thing in our trade relations. When you're talking about regulatory organizations, they are empowered to regulate the terms of trade, literally regulate the terms of trade across these kinds of social, across this boundary created by the existence of these social relations. Right? So you can start to actually endogenize corporate agency, right, into a conception of structure that can be scaled up and down. Right? This is still pretty abstract. I'm not going to go into very specific empirics. If we want to pursue this line of discussion, we can do that. But the punchline is that, to quote myself, because it's always fun, and I haven't memorized it, individuals derive many of their politically significant impulses and attributes, their identities, norms, values, interests, and influence, from their participation in ongoing processes of social interaction. As they pursue goals such as resources and status, they reproduce, modify, create, and sever relatively durable material and symbolic exchange relationships. These relatively durable but fundamentally dynamic interactions constitute the structural context in which individuals operate. It also gives rise to various kinds of relative and analytical macro and micro relations. Right? I think I'm going to stop there, but just to note that I think that if you're on top of some of what Patrick's talking about, or you know that the theories he's drawing upon, you can see why a lot of the debate among people who think about themselves as relationalists is taking place along the diagonal. Right? There is an elective affinity here between a kind of realist position, right, which says that when you're analyzing relationships, whether they're through language about discourse, practice, or social networks, you're getting at sort of deep underlying structures that are embedded in social life, and that the mechanisms you're finding are properties of those social relations and are real mechanisms. So that there's a direct analogy between Bhaskar's discussion about how if you know, a causal mechanism is lodged in the structure of matter itself, and that's how you understand, say, an oxidation-reduction reaction is the dispositional properties of the structure of matter, right, rather than the structure of some sort of agent within that, some anthropomorphized, you know, fire burns because fire wants to burn, right, in its relationship, its activation, its relationship with some other material structure. But there's also a strong relationship with phenomenologists, with analyticism, because you can, one of the major arguments you can also make is that precisely the advantage of this kind of approach, no matter how you cash it out in the analytical language, is that you don't have to think about structure as deep and unobservable. That we can observe structures by observing public relationships, whether it's in terms of speech acts or meaningful practices or by mapping patterns of social transactions. So that there's nothing, this is all phenomenal, right? Or phenomenal, not phenomenal. and that the mechanisms that we abstract from that may be based on ideal typifications of these kinds of relationships, which give you an abstract general way to then configure, in particular, historical moments in social space. So in my own work, I want to know why is it that the Protestant Reformation caused a crisis in the European order. And my argument is that early modern European states had an ideal typical structure that was a center-periphery relationship like empires, and that the spread of religious movements, both in terms of their content and the formal properties that were sometimes emerging from that content, made resistance to the center more easier. Right? And now, the stories I tell are very historically specific and not necessarily replicatable, but the overall ideal type can be abstracted and applied to other settings, like, for example, the impact of political Islamism on composite political communities in the Middle East, or the Russian Federation, which has structural similarities to an empire. Right? So there's a level of generalization there, but not in the nomothetical deductive form you associate with neopositivism. I'll stop there.